Now, last time then, I talked about the young Marx, and I raised the first problem in the young Marx, the problem of alienation, and I tried to make clear that alienation for Marx can only be solved in a social context. The appropriation of labors by others has to cease, and the central instrument to make it cease is the abolition of private property. Always as a means, never as an end. And here I think, lest we again think that the young Marxist Marx was materialist in the sense, let us say, of the Bolsheviks today, or even of Kautsky and Engels later. Let me read to you for a minute his critique of primitive communism, as he calls it, which comes again from the historic economic and philosophical manuscripts of 1844, which were not published till after his death. Crude communism, he said, is only the culmination of such envy and leveling down on the basis of a preconceived minimum. How little this abolition of private property represents a genuine appropriation is shown by the abstract negation of the whole world of culture and civilization, the regression to simplicity. Now, what he is saying, in other words, is that the abolition of private property is a mean to bring out, if you like, the human essence. By the way, this passage I cited when I gave a lecture at the Marx-Engels Institute in the German Democratic Republic, because what you have to tell in communist Germany now is you have forgotten Hegel. Your Marx is not really a Marx. It's primitive communism, your Bolshevism. Well, that was in a brief period of relaxation long past, but never mind. So this passage, I think, puts it very well. This critique of what later on will be misrepresented as Marxist materialism, yes? It will be misrepresented. Or to put it again from the same manuscripts, communism is the positive abolition of private property, of human self-alienation, and thus the real appropriation of human nature through man. So at the bottom is still the appropriation of human nature, and the abolition of private property is a means, not an end, which grows out of a social analysis. But the social analysis is not, as it became perhaps too much in later Marxism, an end rather than a means. And finally, the positive supersession of private property as the appropriation of human life is therefore a positive suppression of all alienation and the return of man from religion, family, and the state to his human life. In other words, the abolition of private property will make it unnecessary for man to have surrogates, the surrogates of religion and the state, the surrogates on which he projects his frustrations. That's something he got from Feuerbach, of course. Religion is due to the frustrations of man. Man makes religion. There isn't, therefore, and that's a very Enlightenment idea, I don't have to tell you, there isn't, therefore, any the need of dreaming, which Lessing, after all, denounced in Nathan the Wise. There is no more need for dreaming, because you have appropriated your nature, and nature is defined through labor. But labor is really a metaphor for creativity. It's not just alienated labor. The idea is to make alienated labor creative again. And I come back, and I'll come back at greater length later, to what Marx said about hunting in the morning and fishing in the afternoon, what he meant is labor becomes creative again and is not industrialized, alienated labor. Therefore, one must not fall into the trap and, as it were, idealize materialism. Now, private property can only be broken when, after all, a class analysis is, if you like, fulfilled. That is when the proletariat overthrows the bourgeois class. The individual, until the overthrow of private property, is not an individual. He is a class-bound person. And as I told you, that has all sorts of consequences, because a class is based on the means of production. And therefore, a class-bound person is alienated from everything that Marx, as a cultured German, thought made life worthwhile. Marx never thought economics made life worthwhile. Marx thought culture made life worthwhile, building. Looking at a diamond for its beauty, not for its economic value. Reading Shakespeare and Balzac and all of these things Marx actually did, yes? Going to the theater and all of this. But as long as you were still a class-bound person, everything was tied into the money nexus, the cash nexus. This he got from Moses Hess. From Moses Hess's famous essay on money. Everything was in the cash nexus. And therefore, there was what Marxists will call a fetishism of goods. Every good was, if you like, fetishized in this way. Thus, as long as you are a class-bound person, you are governed by a kind of predestination. That is to say, by the course of history. By the course of history. As a class-bound person, you are integrated into what for Marx was a determinist course of history. The course of history, which of course meant that, first of all, the dialectic, and the dialectic worked in that feudalism, the bourgeoisie overthrew feudalism. And the bourgeoisie was the new, and feudalism was the old. And now we are at a state when the proletariat must overthrow the bourgeoisie. But then history will, in a way, come to an end as we know it. Because Marx believed, and I must emphasize that again, that the proletariat was not class-bound. Why was the proletariat not class-bound? Because it had no property. It had no property. It did not control the means of production. As the struggles in history are about the means of production, for example, between the bourgeoisie and feudal society, the proletariat must stand outside of it because it has no property. Therefore, it doesn't struggle for the means of production. It struggles for humanity in general. It is the class of liberators of humanities in general. Or to put it in Marxist terminology, it can live for the universal satisfaction of all individual potentialities. It can work for that. The alienation of the proletariat, therefore, represents the alienation of all humanity. Because it has no property, it has no class interests. It therefore, in Marx, comes in a way to stand out outside history, to be indeed the end of history. I want to come back to that later in another connection. Now, with all this said, we must come to the crux of the problem. If man was alienated from himself, what then is the himself from which he is alienated? In other words, to the central crux, does Marx have a theory of human nature? Does Marx only have a theory of history and of economics, or is at the base of Marxism a theory of human nature? That's the crux. As a base upon which alienation and the recapturing of human nature can work, that's a serious matter, because it comes into the problem, is there a Marxist humanism at all? Is the individual in any meaningful sense at the heart of Marx's theory? Now, the existence of a Marxist humanism has, of course, been denied on several grounds by very many modern scholars, Daniel Bell, the sociologists, Isaiah Berlin in his famous biography of Marx, and even the most famous biography of Marx written by a follower of Marx, by Mehring, which is the classic biography, came out in about 1920 by Franz Mehring, the classical biography. They deny it already, and Mehring denies it because he was already a step removed from Marx, as we shall see. They deny it because what they put in the foreground, that for Marx, only social reality matters. And therefore, for Marx, only, as it were, there is what he called objective reality. That not the individual matters, but only classes of men. In the development of historical dialectic, the motives of men count in this for nothing, count for nothing. And perhaps here a title of an equally famous book is about Marx tells a great deal, Sidney Hook's book, Marx the Pragmatist. So this is Marx the Pragmatist, in a way. Emphasizes social reality as the only kind of reality. This puts into the foreground the working of history, the necessity of history, historical necessity. And because, after all, they do know about the young Marx and the young Marx's hesitations, they stress, of course, not the young Marx of the manuscripts, but the older Marx, who seems to concentrate upon economics more than upon the individual. Not the Marx before 1859, but the Marx after 1859. They believe that the class situation, with its alienation, cannot be separated really from anything else. It dominates. And therefore, the later dogmatism of socialist parties is already in Marx. That is, it is already a fault of Marx that the later socialist parties, especially the German Socialist Party, which was a paradigm, became so dogmatic and, as we would say, economically determinist. Yes? Now, the problem, of course, is put perhaps clearer in a way by a French theorist, the most important modern French Marxist theorist, Althusser, who, against all the kind of Marxist revival and the young Marx of Germany of the 1920s, asserted in the 1970s, after all, that this was all nonsense, that you had to read Marx through his greatest work, The Capital, and that you had to read The Capital in a structural way. That is to say, you had to stick to the text, and that when you stick to the text, it becomes obvious that economics is in the foreground, that as far as Marx himself is concerned, there is no other analysis than the analysis, as it were, of a kind of determinism. If you read the Capital in a certain structural way, there is no humanism, but only materialism. This he put forward in a very famous book, How to Read the Capital, or his essays called For Marx. And Althusser maintains that in the 1860s, Marx had left Hegel totally behind. It's, of course, connected all with the Hegelianism in Marx. He left Hegel totally behind. That what matters is class, the proletariat, and not anything idealist or, as he calls it, religious. Now, it's very odd, this kind of oscillation between a kind of revival of Marxism on the basis of the young Marx and then the reaction again saying, no, we must come back to a materialistic interpretation. Now, obviously, Althusser became the philosopher of the French Communist Party because the young Marx will keep alive a kind of ferment outside the Communist Party. And people like Althusser tried to adjust Marx again to what you might call Marxist orthodoxy, the orthodoxy of the Communist Party. So that Althusser in France became extremely popular, I guess he is still today, as a antidote to people like Sartre or to Lukács in Germany and others who had tried to introduce a humanism into Marxism. So that you really get the split of Marxism into two Marxisms. The Marxism of the intellectual, who holds that there is a humanist basis to Marxism, to which I'll come in a minute, and the Marxism of orthodox socialism, then orthodox communism, which hold there is no humanism, but that there is only class, struggle, economic determinism, and which really is not at all concerned with the classless society. You will never find, perhaps outside the rather unorthodox Italian Communist Party today, and even not there, in the Communist parties in Europe, a concern with the classless society, because that would get you into trouble with the Soviet Union, of course. Yes? Because how then can you justify the keeping on the dictatorship of the proletariat indefinitely? So there are these two things, Marxist orthodoxy, which comes about, as we shall see with Engels first, because once you introduce the scientific idea, then you eliminate the humanism. Once you assimilate Marxist history and the class struggle to Darwinist laws of evolution, then there can be no humanist essence, because then everything is a science. And a science, as the end of the century understood it, was devoid of humanism. It was determinism. Don't think of modern science. Think of end of the century science, still Newtonian science. Science is a determinism. Today we know that science discards the idea of truth. But that's a very new scientific idea. As far as Engels knew, they were under the spell of Darwin, not under the spell of Max Planck or anything of this nature, obviously. So when you assimilate this to science, then you get a Marxist orthodoxy, which eventually becomes Bolshevism. Yes, this is the great issue. But I want you to be clear of the issue. Now others, of course, others who tried to revive Marxism against socialism, against communism eventually, in the 1920s, of course, tried to emphasize the humanist base. As one of them, who just died, Ernst Bloch, put it very clearly after the First World War, against Althusser, against this whole trend, as it were, that humanism is recaptured by Marx, by humankind, defining itself through action. And what Bloch means, it's difficult to translate, is, of course, that Marx never dropped Hegel in the fact that in the end, yourself, your individuality, is recaptured through acting according to the class struggle. You act according to the class struggle to recapture your individuality. That life is an interaction between your consciousness of your individuality, because you can't struggle to recapture something you know nothing about, obviously. So there must be a Hegelian self-conscious residue, even among all this alienation, or you would never struggle. That becomes very important later to answer the Marxist question, why struggle at all? Why struggle at all if history is determinate? If history is determinate and the proletariat will win, why struggle at all? And of course, you don't struggle in Engels and you don't struggle in social democracy. This becomes, of course, the beginning. You don't have to struggle. History struggles for you. But for Karl Marx, for whom revolution was the storming of the Bastille, this was not a viable answer. So there was always obviously a residue of a consciousness of yourself. So that in Marx, certainly, Marx never lost the Hegelian interplay between, on the one hand, the class struggle, and on the other hand, your conscious decision to participate in the class struggle in order to recapture your individuality. And this is, of course, the distinction between true consciousness and false consciousness. Now, for this interaction, there is a name, a Greek name, which Marx himself used for that. We call it praxis. That is to say that Marxism is still dependent on the Greek term praxis, which is an interaction between objective reality and human consciousness. Now, it's very typical that the main magazine of this humanist Marxist revival was called Praxis. And it's still more typical that about 8 years ago, the Yugoslav government suppressed it, suppressed this magazine, Praxis. In other words, this kind of Marx is a dagger at Bolshevism. It's a dagger pointed at communism. It's a dagger pointed to Marxist orthodoxy. That must be clear to you, and that is why it becomes very important. On the whole, the question is involved with another one, which gets us back, I think, to our chronological time. Why did Marx never publish these economic and philosophical manuscripts of 1944? Why did he never publish them? And I think the answer that Oscar Hammond gave in a very good book, not enough regarded, I think, called The Red 48ers. The Red 48ers. The answer that Oscar Hammond gave in The Red 48ers seems quite convincing. That some of what he wrote was no longer appropriate in 1845. Why? Not because he rejected what he wrote, but because a new factor had come into the equation. A factor that is clear in your work, that you're reading in the German ideology. What happened? What happened? By 1945, Marx felt that an undue emphasis on humanism would lead to his own movement being confounded with utopian socialism. In the second part of the German ideology, which you, as a matter of fact, not reading, he denounces all other socialists for their general love of humanity. In other words, he comes back again and saying, now look, we are distinguished from Weitling or Proudhon or the other socialists I have, and from Feuerbach, because we don't believe in the general love of humanity. That is quite wrong. We believe in objective social conditions. And therefore, there is a true socialism and a false socialism. By 1845, Marx believed that general talk about humanity weakened the will to action. And he always had the problem of distinguishing his own movement from others. So that in the ideology, he, as it were, makes the break with the other socialists, which he made before, already with the Feuerbach and the French socialists and that whole idea of the generality. So that's underlined now, that break with generality. But that does not mean that he abandoned, as it were, that he abandoned humanist ideas. It does not mean that, that he abandons a basic theory about human nature. Because without that theory, his own theory would not make sense. In other words, to get humanism out of Marxism, you have to go to state socialism. You have to substitute something that is recaptured. And eventually, of course, in social democracy and in Lenin, you go to the state. The state begins to fulfill the function that the individual fulfilled for Marx. Eventually, you come to a kind of state socialism as a substitute, because somehow you have to have a goal. You have to have some kind of a goal why the class struggle has to be abolished. You can't just say that everybody can hunt in the afternoon and fish in the morning. That's no goal. That's a metaphor. So you have to have some kind of goal. And eventually the goal, of course, became the state. And that is why La Salle in German socialism was so relatively more important than Marx. And that is why in the end the Russian state becomes much more important than Marx. But not for Marx. Not for Marx. Because if you read Marx carefully, there are three factors which he assumes as given. And these, I would say, are at the basis of his analysis of the individual, of his humanism, if you like, of his humanity. He believes that three factors are basic and unchanging. And all three come from the Enlightenment. And I think when you read your German ideology, you will see again that this underlies it. These three factors are freedom, happiness, and rationality. That freedom, happiness, and rationality make up what he calls the human essence. Now, because they make up the human essence, they are, as it were, an integral part of human consciousness. Freedom, happiness, and rationality are basic, an integral part of human consciousness. And I dare say, if you think about Marx's theory, without this presupposition, it wouldn't make sense at all. And above all, you can't answer the main question. Why would people go out and storm the Bastille rather than sit home and wait for history to act, you see? Because Marx's theory of revolution is the storming of the Bastille. As you will see, that's why Marx never talks about the dictatorship of the proletariat. Again, His theory of human nature was an Enlightenment optimistic one. Marx believed automatically that when the Bastille fell, the millennium would come about. That is to say, freedom, happiness, and rationality would be activated. In other words, he basically believed that every man would, as part of human nature, wants freedom, wants happiness, and is rational. It's a very Rousseauistic Enlightenment idea, which you've come across before. Very much so. Very much so. Because the Enlightenment, after all, stressed freedom, and the Enlightenment stressed happiness. Glückseligkeit is the main thing about the Enlightenment. Whenever you read any Enlightenment literature, it's always happiness is the goal. Happiness is in the goal. This way Hegel isn't at all an Enlightenment figure. But it's this optimism. Happiness can be obtained. Happiness is the goal. And then rationality. Human rationality will out. Now, these things for Marx are inherent. They drive people to fight the class struggle, and they will triumph after the revolution. There is no need for a dictatorship of the proletariat. There is no need. Now let me put it a little more theoretically now, and perhaps more importantly. Every act of protest is for Marx at the same time an act of understanding and criticism. That is, every act of protest against the bourgeoisie, to put it in the objective reality, is at the same time an act of understanding and criticism, or as we would put it, an act of consciousness. Is at the same time an act of consciousness. So that again you have this kind of praxis intertwined. You have it intertwined. Now let us look at each of these separately for a minute in Marx, and let us start with freedom. Let us look at each of them now. I want to look at them individually a minute. Freedom, happiness, and rationality. In Marx himself. Now, freedom. What about freedom? The freedom of unalienated man. Now, at first, Marx had thought freedom could be expressed through universal suffrage, remember. But then, of course, he integrated it into the class struggle, which means that freedom must be expressed through revolutionary activity. Obviously, through his history and so on, freedom must be expressed through his revolutionary activity. And what he wrote in 1842 as a very young man remains his goal. And I quote, he wrote that in an article for the newspaper he was then writing for, the famous Rheinische Zeitung. Freedom is so much the essence of man that its very enemies realize it in struggling against its reality. And now notice this. No man fights against his own freedom. At most, he fights against the freedom of others. Now, that is essential for you to realize one thing. Why fight at all? Marx assumed that no man fights against his own freedom. At most, he fights against the freedom of others. And Marx, for all his shrewd analysis of the Industrial Revolution, never realized, and this is the great weakness of Marxism and socialism, that is why it is destined to defeat. That was always has been destined to defeat. It will always be destined to defeat because at the basis of socialism is a fallacy. And the fallacy is that men don't like to be slaves. In other words, what Marx never understood with the Industrial Revolution is what the nationalism understood, man's longing for community. Man's longing for community. And that man would sacrifice his freedom or would redefine his freedom to say, I'm not free as an individual, I'm free only in a community. That Marx never realized. He never realized, in other words, the kind of basic longings which accompanied industrialization. I think his economic analysis was very shrewd, though eventually outdated. No economist today would hold any more that Marx in the Capital either forecast properly or was a proper economic analysis. But whatever one might say about this, it's still true that this very civilized man of the Enlightenment, educated in the Enlightenment, could never understand nationalism, could never understand, or fascism, of course, socialists never understood that. Their analysis of fascism was spectacularly wrong. Their analysis of nationalism was spectacularly wrong. So that in a way, let me put it this way, that socialism here already missed its train connection. Yes, the important modern train left the station. The socialists are still waiting on the platform. In other words, what I'm saying is the basic difficulty of socialism, as I see it, why it never amounted to anything in our century, why it went from defeat to defeat, yes? And when it does come to victory in the Soviet Union, it's a mixture between socialism and fascism, more fascism than socialism in Stalinism. What you have, therefore, here is because the rationalism is built in, the Enlightenment is built in, and socialism never can rid themselves, never have an idea of community, never. Eventually, this come out spectacularly when, in the 1920s, after all, socialists never knew what to do with mass movements because they believed in the human essence. So if you went to socialist meetings, you got speeches and speeches and speeches. But when you went to fascist meetings, you got folk dances and sacred fires and mass choruses and everything that is success in the modern world and not failure. So you get this tremendous devotion of socialism to didacticism, to education, to speeches and more speeches. And that's already built in here in Marx's idea then that in the effect that man will never be a slave. He will always fight for his own freedom. I know I'm talking against you now, because you're built in the Enlightenment. It's also an American myth that man would fight for his freedom rather than anything else. I'm sorry to say history is a spectacular contradiction. The great triumph of history, remember, is not socialism or Marxism, but nationalism. Man, modern man wants to have community, doesn't care a damn for anything else, really, in certainly a crisis. He wants community. Now, this is, I think, at the basis. We must say, therefore, that as far as Marxism is concerned, freedom, then, freedom was certainly a permanent ingredient in human nature. The individual urge to individual freedom. He assumes that. He assumes that. Now, this is also important for another reason, that Engels, in the end, will much more believe in historical inevitability, because after Marx again, this was extremely difficult to uphold this Enlightenment idea, because it came into open conflict with the idea of evolution, which has nothing permissive about it. It's a science. So, in other words, Engels will be in a much more difficult way, as you will see, and in his Dialectic of Nature, his most important theoretical works, he will almost reject this kind of Enlightenment idea. Now, with all of this said, let us remember that Marx sees freedom in concrete, not abstract terms. In a very late work of his, The Civil War in France, his work about the Paris Commune of 1870, he makes this remark. In their long struggle, the workers have no ideal to realize but to set free the elements of the new society. They are fulfilling a historic mission, and they have a historic, a heroic resolve. Now, here you have it. A historic mission and a heroic resolve. Objective reality and individual consciousness. The heroic resolve is the individualism. You can't have a heroic resolve under economic determinism, yes? Nothing is more opposed to Bolshevism than heroism. Can you think of a less than a hero than doddering Mr. Brezhnev or the doddering men in the Politburo? That is the logical conclusion of this rejection of individualism. But Marx didn't have it at all. He believed in heroism, the worker as hero, true consciousness, but true consciousness side by side with their historic mission. And in this quote, remember to set free the elements of the new society, you need both. You need historic resolve, and you need, at the same time, the historic mission. Mission. Now, in all of this, then, it is again praxis. But praxis on what basis? And here I want to allude to the second thing, on the basis of rationality. What does rationality mean to Marx? I think I will leave till after Thanksgiving, really. Yes? I leave it till after Thanksgiving, so that after your feasting and your stuff. It's very odd, you know, I've given it a lot of thought, because that's my métier, that's my business, I'm paid for otherwise. Why in modern times all original symbolisms become food fetishes? I really don't know, but it is true, of course. It is true. I shall be killed for that. Jews, food becomes their expression of their Jewishness. And Thanksgiving, which used to be, of course, a pagan festival, a festival of lights, a festival, in a way, of national rededication already, has become simply a food fetishism. Now, that may have to do with capitalism. People are more interested in what the turkey costs than in what it symbolizes. You will see at your dinner, try Marx out at your dinner at home and see what your people talk about, your family, whether they talk about what that symbolizes, the national community, the renewal. The harvest festival is a national festival, the main German, French, and English national festival, because it's a renewal, yes? The harvest. Winter is over. Spring comes. It has a lot of renewal. Workers celebrated it, too, as a kind of idea of renewal, yes? Which had nothing to do with food at all at the beginning, not at all. But which somehow has become transfigured as everything in our civilization. Into a materialistic kind of fetishism, yes? A fetishism, you see? I mean, you have to eat turkey. Why turkey? Well, there is a historical reason, of course, but the turkey is the focus, not the renewal, you see? In spite of the fact that turkeys are never renewed, because my life experience in America tells me nobody knows how to cook a turkey. It's always dry. I am, of course, going. I only accept invitation where there's a goose. So that combines Germanic ideas with renewal, you see, with American Thanksgiving. But never mind about that. But, of course, all I wanted to tell you really or to make you aware of, and the fact that you laugh means you're not really aware of it, that you must analyze with a critical mind especially the what you think are the little and routine things in their life. Now, what is it? The second thing I want to say about Thanksgiving is it is the bourgeois urge for festivals, which only comes from the end of the 19th century. The bourgeois urge for festivals. Why? Becomes very dangerous in the end, because in bourgeois routine, you have to have a new liturgy. You don't go to church, most of you, or the bourgeois don't go to church. You don't have that liturgy. So you have a liturgy, yes? You have a ritual, a liturgy, a religious substitute. And this is this bourgeois urge for liturgy, which the Nazis and fascism fulfilled, of course, in their mass meetings, much the same thing, and which you get only from the end of the century, which you have then in Thomas Mann's novels, already in Fontana's novel, the family festival. Why? The family festival is, first of all, to get you out of the routine of daily life. And secondly, it is also, of course, in a fragmented society, a grasping for community. So that Thanksgiving should be a double festival of the renewal of a national community and the community of the family. But in America, it has become a family thing and a reaffirmation of something that's very primitive in a way, of the larger family. In a nuclear family age, Thanksgiving is the one opportunity you have to gather the larger clan. God knows what you all talk about, but to gather the larger clan. So all these things come together, and I'm saying this to you because as intellectuals, so at least having intellectual pretensions, you should never in your life go to anything like that without thinking about its origins, its meaning, its consequences. Everything is important, and especially the little thing in life have historically determinate meaning. You're going to Thanksgiving because the bourgeois has an urge, not only the bourgeois, everybody these days, for liturgy. It's no longer a religious age, because it is a matter of national renewal, which has become a kind of materialistic token in our world. I think that's very true. I think this is a one-dimensional society in very large degree. I think that is true. It has become a kind of token, yes? And because you have a kind of need, the festival fulfills that in a mass age, just as mass meetings on a political scale, for community. Community. This isn't a community of affinity, because you can't help it. You're born into it. It's not affinity. But you have a longing for community, yes? And as the nation in America is very weak, thank God, it's a very weak idea, the glory of America, I think, you concentrate it on the family. That's your community. It'll fail, because you only meet it once a year, of course. Yes? So at the moment, it substitutes for the other things you go into in order to make up for that. So anyway, as far as Marx is concerned, think about the conversation at your family table. Marx would say is that just as a jeweler no longer knows how beautiful a diamond is because everything is fetishized. So see what your family conversation is about the cheapness of the turkey this year, which I gather has dropped, or is it about national renewal or something else? I can guess. Well, okay.